Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. Show me what scares you, and I'll show you your soul. That's the first line of a new book about America's history with horror. From the Salem witch trials to Stephen King, American Scary analyzes 400 years of terrifying tales, connecting our fictional monsters to historical facts, like the overlap between the rise of the Nazis and our interest in werewolves, two kinds of humans who essentially turned into monsters. Jeremy Dauber is the author of the new book, American Scary, and he joins us now. Welcome to All Sides, Jeremy.
Hi, thanks so much for having me here, Anna.
You're not supposed to judge a book by its cover, but I do judge books by their first lines. And I loved yours. Show me what scares you and I'll show you your soul. You then go on to write, you can write America's history by tracking the stories it tells itself to unsettle its dreams, rouse its anxieties, galvanize its actions. And I was like, okay, immediately, yes, I need to know more. How did you land on this idea of tracking our history through our horror?
Well, you know, one of the things that I'm a professor at Columbia, and, you know, I taught this as a class. And one of the things you always do when you're thinking about how to arrange a class is how are you going to put this together, all the things you like and the stuff you're interested in. And, you know, chronologically seemed a natural thing. And as I started putting these things together, I said, you know, there's really a way of telling this story historically, not just chronologically. And I always kind of knew ever since I was a kid and I had read Stephen King's nonfiction book, Danse Macabre, that he had made some kind of argument about this for the post-war period, the immediate post-war period. And I said, oh, you know, you could do this for all of America. So I'm going to give that a try. and that's how this came about, the class and Stephen King.
The book divides our scary stories into two broad categories. The, quote, fear of something grand, something cosmic, like the devil or hell, and the, quote, monster located right next door, which in early America was indigenous tribes and, of course, witches. Although I guess witches could be both, like cosmic and devil next door.
And I think that's one of the reasons why Salem was so important. I mean, it's so important because it becomes a touchstone in America. We come back to it over and over again. But it also so really neatly combined both of these big buckets of fear, like you're saying, and in one sort of package. You have this sort of grand cosmic threat of hell that really is concretized in the people who are right around you, the people who live in your house, and those are certain women, marginalized women, people of color, like Tituba, the enslaved person who becomes figured early on. It's all right there. And so it became a perfect sort of launching pad for our fear.
Women have remained a focal point in our scary stories, both fiction and nonfiction, throughout America, from The Yellow Wallpaper, which is an amazing short story. If people have not read it, will take about half an hour of your time, to The Stepford Wives. And I would even argue the movie Promising Young Woman. You know, The Handmaid's Tale I read in high school, and then it had this huge resurgence in the Me Too era.
I think that, and what you're saying, I think, is really so important because, you know, some of these books, The Handmaid's Tale is a book that comes out, if I'm remembering correctly, in the 80s. But these monsters, these questions, these figures change to meet the particularities of a historical moment. So, you know, 40 years later, you know, as you say, Handmaid's Tale takes on a very new life in the 2010s and now. In a similar way, that figure of the witch, you know, as I sometimes say to my class, in the 1690s in Salem, a witch is one thing. And in the 1990s in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, a witch is something else. But they both traffic in some of these same sort of questions. They're just dealt with in different ways.
Yeah, we've fairly in like from practical magic to hocus pocus. There's been an embracing of the witch trope, sort of a reclaiming of it by women generally, I think.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think, you know, in the late 1990s, you have figures like, you know, in the girl power sort of, right, you have, and in Buffy the Vampire Slayer and things like that, who are saying, this is about taking on autonomy and agency. And the ways in which that can play itself out in the 1990s are, of course, very different than in Puritan Massachusetts Bay Colony, and allow for very different kinds of resurgences of old discomforts, anxieties, and fears.
Yeah, and one of the tropes in a lot of horror stories around women, older ones, is she makes a terrible mistake. She does something that, quote unquote, good girls are not supposed to do. It sort of gets catalyzed in Scream in the 90s, where, spoiler alert, I guess, but like the movie's 20 years old, so I don't know what to tell you, but where he says, you know, once you have sex, you die, as a woman in a horror film.
I think that's right. And, you know, the Scream, which is a wonderful movie, very bad, you know, is playing with the tropes of these 1980s slasher movies, which come out in that kind of Reagan moral majority moment, and really get to another kind of two divisions of horror stories. One of which, you know, of what I call conservative or radical horror. And that isn't necessarily about partisan politics, but a conservative horror movie or work says someone commits a crime. I'll put crime in quotes, and then they get punished for it, sometimes disproportionately, sometimes horribly, but they do something wrong. And so much of that was saying, if you are someone who has, you know, intimate relations, a little, and mostly if you're a woman who has intimate relations out of marriage, right, you get that's a crime, and you get punished horribly. And that really comes out, and that sort of is a very fertile ground for anxiety and repression and fear in these decades coming forward.
You also ask us to expand our definition of horror and monsters, which I loved, and I had never really thought about it until I got the book. And you talk about everything from American slavery to the Trail of Tears to the Nazis, but also the murder of George Floyd, the carnage in Vietnam, and I would argue even more recently, right here in Ohio, the fear that immigrants were stealing and eating pets. You kind of classify all of these as scary stories that we tell ourselves.
I think that, you know, I think that's right. I mean, the main thing that I took as my kind of brief, so to speak, in writing this book was what scared Americans. And a lot of the times I did that because the lines between fiction and nonfiction, between truth and narrative, are really very blurry. And you see that just even in the stories about Ohio that you were talking about, right? You have a fear that's grounded in some kind of phenomenon, that is to say that there are immigrants, right, that are coming, right? And then you take it into these pernicious and baseless fictions that play into tropes of the fear of the immigrant, which is as old as America itself, right? The baseless fear, right? And so, and sometimes that occurs in fictions that pass themselves off in newspapers and reports, and sometimes that plays itself out in sort of subterranean works, subterranean themes, excuse me, in things that are clearly coded as fiction that appear in pulp periodicals or what have you, right? So it was, I wanted all of that to be part of the story because it's all part of our story.
Yeah, I particularly love this comparison between the Nazis and werewolves, this fear of the seemingly normal person that becomes a monster. And I had to sit with that for a moment, and I was like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So thank you. I mean, you know, it was so interesting to me as saying, you know, here in the pre-World War II period, Germany, thought of as one of the most civilized nations in Europe, perhaps the most civilized nation, and all of a sudden, you know, here is this transformation, right? And what monster kind of gets your head around that, right? And then, as you're saying, that's these werewolves. And then, you know, again, as you were saying, I try to expand this story to saying, okay, we've beat the Nazis, thankfully, fantastic, you know, but what makes us think that that kind of capacity for monstrosity isn't in our hearts as well? And that turns into this film noir, which is not normally considered part of the horror genre, but I think is very much part of our fears, that you scratch, you know, an insurance salesman and you find someone who's willing to commit a homicide, right? That's what we're scared of, is this monster within us. And that comes out very powerfully post-Nazis and post-Holocaust.
I think it still persists today, because I think one of the scariest things about werewolves was always this idea that you could be one and not know it.
That's great. That's a great way of framing it. Yeah, I think that's right. You know, a lot of horror is about what will you do, you know, if you are pushed to it. In the Walking Dead television series.
Great show.
Love the show. Right. The Rick Grimes always asks two questions. Right. And the first question is, how many walkers, you know, have you killed? But the second question is, how many humans have you killed? And the show, in some sense, struggles and maybe even goes all in on the idea that actually in this kind of post-apocalyptic landscape, humans are the monster, right? They're the killers, they're the murderer, right? You can kind of deal with the zombies, but it's sort of what comes out afterwards. And in that sense, it's a very interesting sort of moral show, show that deals with moral questions, at least.
Yeah, I would put what's it called? Now I just spaced on the name, but I would put Yellow Jackets, the new TV show, in that
Oh.
category. I would put Lord of the Flies, that's what I was trying to think of, in
Oh,
that category.
okay.
Sort of
Sure.
quintessential, like chaos ensues when lawlessness abounds.
Yeah, and I think that's what horror and the fiction and the not, but the horror, fiction of fear really does is it takes these questions and it says, we're going to put these to the breaking point and we're going to present them in a way that you, as the audience, can say, well, I'm probably not going to deal with a plane crash where I have to do these, but I can think about what kind of person I would be in that circumstance. And sometimes it's very good, the best at shattering certain illusions we might have about ourselves. Like, are you really kidding that you would be perfectly 100% moral in that situation? Maybe you would be, but maybe not. Think about it, sit with it.
That's one of the reasons I like horror as a genre, is because it allows you to test out these questions in a safe setting. And what I found fascinating was at the start of the pandemic, there was a study that found people who watched scary films, particularly those involving mass chaos, such as alien invasions, apocalypses, said they felt more mentally prepared for the pandemic than people who didn't watch them. So I will admit, in like March of 2020, I decided to finally watch Contagion. Maybe that was a poor life choice, but I don't know. It didn't scare
But maybe it
me.
wasn't, right? Maybe
Yeah.
it wasn't the poor life choice.
I like that people who consume horror feel more prepared for scary times.
Well, and I think that I like that too. And I remember actually I was with my wife in March 2020, and I was like, I have, and I live in New York City. I'm a professor, call me. I was like, I have seen this movie, right? I literally, I know what's gonna. And thankfully, it was not. I mean, it was terrible, but it was not as bad as a movie like Contagion or this sort of the apocalypse, or even the pandemic from 100 years before. But it will be very interesting to see in the next 15 and 20 years how COVID makes its way into as allegory and into the fiction of fear.
Yeah, I think it's too raw right now. I've seen, just pe a lot of book publishers say they're not ready for COVID books yet, but it'll come.
One of the most interesting things for me that I thought about in writing the book was the way in which you don't have that much fiction of fear that's, as you say, sort of right about the flu pandemic of 1919, 20. But I think that Dracula, that first vampire movie, is really a pandemic thing,
Oh.
right? You have this kind of wasting disease that sort of is a, you know, it's viral in a certain way, although they wouldn't have used it that way then. And young people are dying for no, I mean, it very much has that vibe to it. And I think it was a way of people working through some of these issues.
I hadn't even thought of that. I did a lot of reading on that pandemic. Again, I don't know what I was thinking in spring of 2020, but yeah, I think we have a hard time conceptualizing what that was like. But there was a street, I want to say it was in New Jersey possibly, that's called Shades of Death Road. And it was
Oh,
for
wow.
where they used to pile all of the bodies. And there's like a lake too where they would sink them because they just didn't have time, money, expediency to get the bodies like buried in a timely manner.
Yeah, and I think it's just, you see these scenes, and they are in some sense impossible to process almost even.
Yeah.
And so then we put them into our subconscious, and then they come out. And that's the job of the story that I tell, is to say, well, how do all these things, whether it's the pandemic or Hiroshima, right, how do they come out in these ways, in these fictions, in the ways that we scare ourselves cathartically?
Coming up, we're going to talk about horror movies, scary characters, and we also want to hear from you. What is your favorite unsettling story? Book, film, fiction, true story. Give us a call at 614-292-8513, or you can email your spooky story to allsides@wosu.org. Your stories and more when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald
Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking this hour about why we love to be scared, why we watch horror movies, read scary books, and what these activities say about our society. Our guest is Jeremy Dauber, author of the new book, American Scary, a history of horror from Salem to Stephen King and beyond. Jeremy, I think horror, more than any other genre, captures our anxieties and transforms them into entertainment. As we were saying, it's a safe way to experience scary things. Prepare for the worst-case scenario. You've said in an interview that the 1955 movie The Night of the Hunter is the scariest movie to you. And spoiler alert, though, 1955, it involves a serial killer who poses as a preacher. So I'm going to play a cut, and then I was hoping you could tell us how this cut fits into the plot.
Leaning, safe and secure from all alarms. Leaning on the everlasting arms.
So that sounds like a hymn. That's supposed to be comforting, but this is a horror movie.
You know, considering, I will say that the person who is singing the hymn at this point is a let's call him a sociopathic or psychopathic murderer who is in the garb of a preacher, although he is certainly not a man of God. I think it's not comforting. I agree with you. And what I've said, as you say, is it is my favorite horror movie. There's no question. And it is very scary, although there are not any jump scare. Well, not really any jump scares in the way that we think about it. It is, to me, the most American horror movie. It is the one that says the most about the night side of America. And one way is the way that American religion, which is a comforting, soulful, powerful institution, can at times, with the wrong hands that in this case are tattooed with love and hate on each knuckle, curdle into something horrific. It's a movie about a man whose psychopathy is driven by, and this gets back to something we said in the previous segment, a hatred of women. It is a way in which it is the myth and fairy tale can be brought into life. This is a story about a hidden treasure and children who are brave, and a big bad wolf that comes and haunts at their door. And so it brings particular social issues, particular American cultural issues, a very specific setting, all together in one package. Oh, and before I forget, it is actually based on a novel, but it's actually based on a true crime story. So all of those things make this a really important package and just a great movie. I envy you your first watching if you haven't seen it.
I have not seen it, so I will definitely add it. I will say the scariest movie of all time for me, like the one that got me the most, unsettled me the most, was The Ring.
Mm. How old were you when you saw it?
19.
Okay. Yeah, so there you go. Yeah, go on. I'm sorry.
I was going to say just the way that movie ends. Oh, I don't know how to explain it. I am still creeped out. Like the image of the girl with the hair over her face coming out of the television. It's just like, uh-uh.
Right. Well, and I think that, you know, there are a number of things. First, I think, you know, there's an old saying that the golden age of science fiction is 12. And there's this idea that, you know, when there's something at an impressionable age, and I think 19 is also, you know, in that game. Right. Wow. Like these things stay with you.
Yeah.
The other, you know, The Ring was this point where, right, really a certain kind of horror visual, a kind of Asian horror, really makes its way into our American imagination.
It felt different than like any other horror movie that I'd ever seen.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, of course, you know, being scared in a new way rather than saying, Oh, I appreciate the particular angles of how they did this thing. It's very innovative. You know, you're like, whoa, you know, so there's that. And then finally, I think, you know, this idea of, right, one thing that we always say is there's safety. You know, okay, I'm going to close the screen and I'm going to leave. But if it's coming out of the screen at you know what I mean?
Oh,
It
yeah.
can stay with you, right? It's a metaphor for staying, for haunting.
Yeah, it also kind of dovetails. It wasn't exactly new technology at the time, but fear and new technology is a genre that's been around throughout American history. You know, alien to me is the fear of space exploration. You know, there is always fear whenever we get something new. Minority Report, the fear of Big Brother. I would argue even Terminator. I mean, as AI gets more advanced, you know, there's some small part of me that's like, is that correct? Is the Matrix right?
Well, one of the things I love telling the story about in the book is the way in which, you know, as you say, sort of new technologies create new ways of scaring people. And that's true of like of all sorts of things. So for example, the Terminator, if you watch it now, is really a movie about answering machines, which were brand new at the time. And actually, Arnold Schwarzenegger kind of acts like an answering machine. Like you call and he answers in sort of the voice of the person who's supposed to be home. Trust me on this. Go watch the
I'll
movie.
think about,
And
yeah, I'll go rewatch it.
but also that the new technologies for experiencing horror also change the way we think about it. So, for example, right around the time the Terminator comes out, everybody is getting a VCR, right? A little bit more. And what that means is that like you can watch all of the scary bits over and over again if you want to. Or you know, you could find something in your video store that wouldn't have been in the theater for 15 years, but you're like, oh, I like this, I'm gonna like that. And so it really, you can really have horror genre fans much more widely than you ever did before. Technology.
Found footage is also a genre that emerged probably at the beginning of the 20th century, where we watch films allegedly recorded by people who are missing or dead. You also see this trickle into novels. I would say The Blair Witch, and you cite it in your book, is kind of the iconic found footage horror movie.
So I will say, I suspect that I'm a little, I know I'm a little older than you. And so I was able to watch the Blair Witch Project in the theaters. And I was terrified, right? I mean, I knew at the end, and again, I apologize for spoiling this, right? It ends with a kind of the camera just showing the space. And I knew with a knowledge that went beyond all other knowledge that something insanely and ineffably terrifying was going to look into the camera and I was going to die of a heart attack, right? Like just in the movie theater. And of course, that's not what exactly what happens. I'm not going to ruin it
The
entirely, but
ambiguity of it makes it worse.
much worse. Because then I thought about it for 20 years, as opposed to, you know, just being like, oh, okay, that was terrifying, but like, okay, I'm dealing with it, right? And you're
Yeah.
100% right.
We got an email from Barb who read The Stand by Stephen King, and she says some people compare the COVID pandemic to the illness in The Stand. I think that's an interesting take.
I think it's a very interesting take, and I think it's exactly right. You know, it's this idea that again, you know, what wipes out the world is not you know, nuclear exchange, which would have been, you know, part of this Cold War at the time, or, but as one of the characters says, just the flu, right? I mean, that lands very hard now.
Yeah.
I think there's a new anthology of tales from the world of the Stand that's coming out very soon. So, you know.
Oh. Another common trope in horror novels for me is or you see it in movies too, is the win to the loss. So like you inherit a mansion from your dead aunt that you didn't know about, but it turns out to be haunted, or you buy something at a great price, like the Amityville Horror. There's all these too good to be true horror twists.
One of the things that I loved about Stephen King, who is in the subtitle, I love him so much in the book, right? But they come that right is this kind of flinty American New England, right? One of the homes of horror, right? Sensibility of nothing's free, right? And so you know, you win something, you get something. If it's too good to be true, it 100% is. And that exactly is that win to loss ethos that you're talking about, Anna. Like it's just, you know. We as Americans almost should mistrust anything that's too good to be true because we're not suckers. And so many of the characters there act like, you know, oh, okay, I'm sure this old house is fine. There's no mysterious secret beneath the floorboards here, you know.
I do love those. I will say, I think my favorite Stephen King novel and the one that epitomizes this for me is Needful Things.
Yes. I just reread that a couple of
times. Oh, it's so good. It's so unsettling.
It's so unsettling. And it's the way, I mean, you know, what I love about it, in addition to this ethos that we're talking about, is the way that an entire town, you know, can just be ripped apart. You know, I mean, you know, it takes some machinations to get there, but like, oh, and everybody changes. And you know, that's something that we fear, is that, again, like we were saying before, there's this veneer of civilization, and underneath, people are able and willing to do madness.
What's your favorite Stephen King book?
You know, it is sad to just be this cliched, but if the golden age of science fiction is 12, the golden age of Stephen King for me was 13 or so when it came out. And I read this 1135 or so page novel, and it just sort of said to me everything. It said everything about a certain kind of horror novel.
The movie is also spooky. I would argue read the book. It's like, obviously 1,100 pages cannot be captured in a 2-hour movie, but that scene with Pennywise and the boat and like the storm grate, like, ugh.
It's so good. And, you know, and I think that, you know, so much of these movies that are based on great novels, you know, you want to see them. You want to see what it looks like. And if they can pull it off even 90%, 80%, 95%, you're getting a lot out of it. And I think that's what's going on with a movie like that.
Needful Things movie, not so good. Do not recommend. But I want to take a call from Catherine in Columbus. Welcome to All Sides, Catherine.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
So you really like The Yellow Wallpaper. I will admit, I love it too.
I love The Yellow Wallpaper. And I have a YouTube channel where I read short stories. So I had it suggested to me to read by several people. And when I first read it, I thought, oh, I don't know if this really fits the genre of horror, because I'd asked for suggestions for like spooky season for October. And then the next time I read it, I was just struck by, you know, it's just a very real horror. This is like true horror, the horror of the patriarchy and oppression and the horror of the lack of mental health care, especially women's, in 1893 when this is written. And I totally just started appreciating the horror of the mundane, I guess, in that period of time. And so I read it several times while I was reading it for my channel, and just all of the metaphors that she has in there about the wallpaper being a prison and, you know, the woman being trapped in there, and you just get to watch her slowly kind of disintegrate as a person. And I just thought it was just so splendidly done.
If you think about what makes that so scary, I agree with her, is that women were institutionalized by their partners for being annoying, essentially, sometimes.
I think that's right. And, you know, I hope I'll get a chance to track this down, because I do think, you know, it's that voice, this voice. It is such a great story to read out loud, because we hear this woman's voice, you know, and this unreliability, this descent into madness. And I talk about this in the book, this breathtaking, even to this day when I read it, this breathtaking switch in the way that she sort of tells the narration. I'm not going to ruin it. You should go read or hear the story. You know, it really is a remarkable story. And all of that is put in, as the caller says, by this patriarchy. It's all pushed in, and by this unreliable partner, this terrible partner, you know, who's a doctor, right?
I have a difficult question for you. What's your favorite horror novel? Is it it, or?
It is a good question, and it depends on the year, I would say. It is a difficult question. Let me think about that for a second.
Yeah.
I think that what I love, maybe it is my favorite novel, but I think that horror is almost sometimes best effectuated by the short story. King is a great horror novel, but there's this sense of, you get an effect, you get a sensation, a stab in the dark, and then you're out, but you're not out, because it stays with you forever. So horror stories by King, by Harlan Ellison, by mid-century people like Matheson, they're all great. Richard Matheson. they're all fantastic.
Yeah.
Maybe my yeah, go on. You
I
know
was going to
more.
say, I think I sometimes you can have recency bias. I just finished The Children on the Hill by Jennifer McMahon. Terrifying
Yeah.
book. Very good read. Did not see the twist coming, which does not always happen for me. I can usually figure them out. But I was thinking about that, like Shirley Jackson's Haunting of Hill House.
That's a
That's
great
a
novel.
doozy.
Yeah.
But I was also thinking, you know, when I was a kid and reading Roald Dahl's The Witches. The witches scared the crap out of me as a child. And you also write about sort of horror or like the creepy, even in Disney. So you talk about Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs and how the Evil Queen, who is just classic, and we're going to play a quick cut of her.
Slave in the magic mirror, come from the farthest space. Through wind and darkness, I summon thee. Speak. Let me see thy face.
Such a good scene.
Such a great scene. And you know, when Walt Disney, the actual individual, sort of talked to his animators about Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, he said, "I want you to model the scene in which the princess, excuse me, the witch changes from sort of the beautiful figure into the sort of hag, for lack of a better phrase, on sort of the transformations that are in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde in the movies that have come out before. It's really designed as a horror story." But one of the things I talk about in the book with Snow White, which I think is in some ways one of the most important cultural products of the 1930s, is also that it's sort of a Great Depression story too. You have this young woman, she's sort of homeless. She doesn't have a job. She has to find sort of a new community of strangers. You know, they work at the mines. You know, and in some ways, there's this sort of upper class that is homicidally bent on their destruction. This resonated with people in this newfangled picture palace world that they could come and fantasize about the tables being turned.
I mean, we always joke about Disney being darker than you think it is, but it is. I
It is.
mean,
It is.
Bambi's mother dies.
Yeah. I think
Finding
that's what.
Nemo, even the more modern ones, like Encanto, tragic backstory.
I think they understand that, you know, in order f that this is part of the tapestry of the human experience. You know what I mean? Is that, you know, that's the lesson of Inside Out, which I think is a masterpiece, right? Is that you can't just have joy all the time. You have to have all of these things to make the joy mean more. And I think that's the truth of fear. You can't have, I mean, I'm saying this, of course, but you can't have the catharsis and the relief without going through this, at least in a fictional context.
Yeah, we got an email from Rob, and I'm glad that he sent it because we can't let this time go by without talking about The Exorcist, both the book and the movie. He said it chilled him to the bone, especially growing up Catholic. And there is a whole genre of exorcism and this dark side of demons and devils.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, you know, on one level, you know, it gets very much back to kind of the monster within us, right? Is and there was a way in which The Exorcist, both the book and the movie, which come out sort of at the turn of the 70s, roughly, are about all of these anxieties about this younger generation that seems, you know, they seem perfectly sweet in it, but all of a sudden they've turned into these foul-mouthed, sexually obsessed, terrible. What's going on? And you know, that's all the greatest generation looking at the baby boomers and saying, you know, what's happened to this cohort? But it's also, and you know, I think there's a movie about, and it was interesting to watch this. You know, the emailer is saying this as a particular perspective. I watched The Exorcist before I was a parent, and then I watched it again after I was a parent. And the scariest thing to me now is not the head spinning around or
The crab walk down the stairs backwards. Oh my goodness.
right, but it is a mother seeing her daughter in pain and putting her through all these medical procedures and nobody knowing exactly what's wrong with her.
I haven't watched it since I became a parent. Now I don't think I'd want to.
You may not want to. You may not want to, right? But it's interesting. Like it's the same, you know, the same frames on the screen, right? And that's one of the things about going back and visiting some of these things is that you just realize these works of art, what you can find in them in different ways. And that's been a fun
Yeah,
journey.
I think any woman struggling with infertility should stay the heck away from Rosemary's Baby. Like,
Oh, yeah.
there's that whole trope too of growing the monster inside you.
Yeah. And the gaslighting. I mean, all of these men just saying, "Oh, this is what pregnancy is like. It's all fine. Of course you should be in agony, you know." And that again, you know, when I was little and I was like, oh, I'm sure the thing I'm going to be the most scared of is the demon child, the, you know, that we're, but no, like, is what will, ha what is happening to Rosemary? Is it really the Rosemary and not the baby, so to speak?
Yeah, that's kind of why I think I like The Haunting of Hill House, because it's really about the protagonist and the question about whether she's losing touch with reality. I think so much of horror, people think, oh, it's jump scares, it's gore, it's blood, it's slashers. But so much of it, when it's really good, is character driven.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that, you know, the House of Terror, the haunted House of Terror has many rooms, and wherever you want to be, I'm here for you. You know, that's great. But I do think that even the movies that are, let's say, gore struck and all that, right? If you don't have things that you identify with, they're just not going to be quite as impressive, except perhaps in a technical way. So, you know, someone even like, you know, not even, but someone like Sam Raimi in The Evil Dead, is able, which is, certainly has its share of gore, is able to create a kind of story and character in which we begin to feel for some of these characters. And I think that that's really important what you're saying. And certainly for things like The Haunting of Hill House, which I teach regularly and is one of the great American novels, full stop, right? If you, is all about these internal sort of deliberations of Eleanor and of these characters, which really makes it a masterpiece.
That was Jeremy Dauber, author of the new book American Scary, A History of Horror from Salem to Stephen King and Beyond. Thank you so much. This was a fun conversation about horror.
It was a delight. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Coming up, how our bodies react to fear and why we keep coming back for it. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Watching scary movies is growing in popularity. In 2014, horror movies made up about 2.5% of the annual box office. Today, it's jumped to 12.75%. Neuroscientist Richard Sema is here to talk about how fear affects our brains, our bodies, and maybe why we can't seem to get enough of it sometimes. He writes about brain matters for the column at the Washington Post. Welcome to All Sides, Richard.
Thanks so much for having me, Anna.
So, what happens in our brains when we watch a scary story or read a scary story?
Yeah, you know, something that's scary is threatening to us. So it activates a whole slew of brain networks that are involved with detecting fear and responding to fear. So neuroscientists have put people in brain scanners while they were watching different scary movies. I noticed, you know, when people were feeling scared and when they were anticipating, you know, during those quiet moments, they're anticipating that jump scare, that murderer lunging out from the screen. And yeah, places like the amygdala, which is very central to fear, but also places dealing with emotion, react as if the threat were actually real. And during those quiet periods, it seems like places in the brain that are, you know, trying to sense, trying to see, trying to hear better, are also really activated, as if, you know, they're trying to figure out where this threat is and trying to make sure that they anticipate it to the best of their ability. And I wanted to also point out that it is kind of odd, if you think about it, that people would seek out this sensation, because fear is generally not considered a fun feeling to have. And yet here we are, we watch scary movies, we listen to true crime podcasts, might watch nature documentaries, which involves this sort of predatorial, scary stalking stuff that you would see in a horror movie. And, you know, we even play peekaboo with our babies. You know, it's like a tiny jump scare for a tiny human. So something there is still fun, even if we don't always think of what we're doing as, seeking out fear as a fun thing.
I had never thought of the peekaboo to Stephen King pipeline before you.
Yeah, it runs deep.
Maybe my parents played a lot of peekaboo with me. I'm gonna have to call my mom later and find out. But what is there any sense from the scientists who study it that in some way maybe we like it because we're preparing, like we're having safe experiences of fear in a way that make us feel like we're better ready for the horrors of real life?
So the researchers I talked to who studied this, they identified three basic categories of people who are horror fans. One is just the straight up, they love the adrenaline rush. They love that, sensation of, getting something that's really, really scary and then having that relief that comes afterwards. But then there are other people who were, less likely to lean into it. Some are what they called white knucklers. They sort of try to lean out of the experience, try to like poke fun at the horror movie or like try to tell jokes to psychologically distance themselves. But for them, it was more like trying to learn about their own capacity for dealing with fear. And a third category, which I found was interesting, was what they called dark copers, where the scary movie or that horror, like haunted house experience, sort of gave them something to focus their own anxieties about the general world on. And it's like that's something more controllable and manageable.
What did you call
So,
that last
yeah.
one? The dark?
Dark copers,
Okay,
they
that's
use it to
probably
net.
the category I've had.
Yeah, it's like, okay, like there is something I could focus on why I feel maybe anxious or nervous or fearful about something. But okay, now I have a reason. It's because Mike Myers is, hunting down someone on screen. And, it's a way of letting us play with our emotions so we could teach ourselves how to be better regulate it in the long term.
Yeah, I've always joked that for most of my career, I covered politics and public policy and all of that. And I've always said there's some correlation between my love of politics and my love of horror, and maybe it's the dark coper.
Yeah, maybe, because there's a lot of emotion running in politics, and horror is one way of helping us, understand how we feel about things and how we can deal with it.
Are there long-term benefits or long-term downsides from being scared on a regular basis? Because we know, particularly with children, if they grow up in unsafe environments, that adverse impact scale, like there's real harm to growing up in a place where you don't feel safe. Can we get the same negative effect from like too much scary stuff?
Yeah, you bring up a great point about like real threats or real threat, yeah, like fear for our safety, for our well-being, such as growing up in, a rough childhood. Like that has long-lasting impacts, but that's very different, I think, from if you choose to go see a horror movie with friends or go to a haunted house. On some level, you know that the threat that you're feeling, it feels real in the moment, but you also know that it's not actually
Real.
Real. So there doesn't seem to be any long-term like bad effects. In fact, there is some evidence that it might help people cope with really stressful situations. Like there's a study showing that during the pandemic, the early part of the pandemic, people who were horror fans on average were more psychologically resilient. And it the researchers, hypothesize this might be because of their exposure and self-understanding of how they respond to danger because of, all the fear that they were playing with, when it was not real.
Like, I've seen this movie before. Quite
Yeah,
literally,
yeah.
if you've watched Contagion.
Yeah, exactly the idea.
Research has also found that men tend to be more drawn to horror than women, but women are more drawn to true crime. And I find that split fascinating.
Yeah, I do wonder about that, and I actually have no research to back up like why that would be. It could be that the true crime genre does have more of that social element of like, yeah, why did this happen? Like, who are these people involved? What was their dynamic? Whereas that might not be as strongly, like present in a lot of horror movies, and I wonder if that's partially explaining the difference.
I do wonder if it's also the dark coper that like women grow up inherently more afraid of, you know, being caught while running, being attacked by someone in the dark. And something about true crime feels almost like preparing in a dark way. So I do wonder if perhaps there's like societal reasons why women are more drawn to true crime.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense from talking with my like female friends who do see it as sort of a like, oh, here's what to look out for. Here are the warning signs. And being able to share that information through story and with each other, I think could be very useful. That's a great point.
There are people out there, though, who do not like horror, who will not watch scary stories, who don't read dark books. And it's just, I guess it's just a difference of personality. Or, I mean, I'm really curious always if our brains are just wired differently, if we hate horror or we can't get enough of it.
Yeah, I think the researchers I spoke to do argue that we all try to find a sweet spot to what is, you know, scary enough that we get some thrill out of it, but not like, you know, if it's not scary enough, then it's kind of boring. And maybe some people's threshold for too much and actually anxiety producing is much lower. So, you know, that sort of plays into the people who like maybe make jokes or like, you know, turn on the lights when they're watching horror movies. They're sort of calibrating how real, how visceral, how threatening it feels to them. So there's definitely individual differences and, you know, there's nothing necessarily wrong about that, but
like I think people who like roller coasters and people who don't.
Oh yeah. But there's, you know, different levels of roller coaster.
Yeah.
Too,
oh yeah.
Which, yeah. Yeah, which, you know, allows some degree of calibration. So I think, you know, for people who want to try it out, you could start small and figure out what like gets enough enjoyable experience for you, but not going over the line where you're actually like stressed out long afterwards.
I think that's so hard. Like, you could definitely, like, I was in my head, I'm like, should we have a rating system for, like, you know, mildly scary, terrifying? But I think it's so different for everyone. Like, if you are, we had somebody who called in earlier, I think actually they might have emailed and said that they were a Catholic and The Exorcist terrified them.
Yes, definitely.
You know, for me, it's like ghosts, because I'm like, I could fend off a crazy psycho killer. How do you hide from a ghost? And so I think what scares everybody is so unique to their personality.
Yeah. And what you find like scary is like something that also has to relate to your worldview, right? Like, this is more real if you're Catholic, right? Like, this is more of a real possibility, more of a real threat, I think.
Yeah.
The researchers also point out that different types of engagement might be more, like if you're watching a movie, it's maybe more scary than if you're reading a book and you're able to imagine things a little differently versus like going to a haunted house where it's even more visceral because you're actually there.
Yeah, some of those haunted houses, the more serious ones, will have like waivers. Like, I do not have a heart condition. I do not have this. And I know they're just like CYA in that situation, but it's also unsettling. They're like, if you die, that is not our fault.
I think that also helps them sell like, oh, this is going to be
so scary.
Like, as yeah, exactly.
So but... part for the lawyers, part for the drama.
Yeah. Yeah. But there are strategies. Like, the one researcher wrote A Very Nervous Person's Guide to Horror Movies, and he recommends like, you know, Studio Ghibli movies, which are, you know, like My Neighbor Totoro or Spirited Away, which, you know, have like less scary like animations, but it can be quite scary. But it's not as gruesome as, you know, The Exorcist, for example. And there are ways that you could ease your way in and maybe, you know, learn how to regulate your emotions better through this type of recreational fear.
You could also, I guess, pick horror with happy endings. There aren't that many.
Yes, that's
there's
true.
A whole genre of like super scary, but with a happy ending.
Yeah, we'll have to find a playlist or a movie recommendation. I think that's a great thing to recommend to people.
I would say I just finished The Children of the Hill House. I think that's how it's phrased. It's by Jennifer McMahon. Scary book, lots of twists, did not see it coming, happy ending.
Oh, that's great. I'll have to check that out. I also liked It Follows. It's not quite a happy ending, but it's like more uplifting than some of the other horror movies I'd seen. Yeah.
So it's safe to say, Richard, that horror spooky stories have been around for as long as there have been people. So it's just, at some level, it's just part of who we are as humans.
Yeah, it's, you know, how we enjoy, you know, if we're feeling safe, that we could play with fear. But also it's a way of learning about ourselves and maybe transmitting useful information about, oh, what's scary out there? Don't do that. Or here's what you do if you're in this situation. Yeah, so it's interesting that we have so much history with it.
My producer says it's The Children on the Hill. So The Children on the Hill by Jennifer McMahon. Definitely check it out.
Excellent.
That was neuroscientist Richard Simov. He writes the Brain Matters column for The Washington Post. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening to this spooky hour of All Sides right here on 89.7 NPR News.